Russell Hsiao, our executive director, and he's going to say a few words before our chairman gives a little speech. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Melissa, and welcome everyone to GTI's inaugural symposium. It is my distinct honor now to introduce the chairman of the board of GTI, Dr. Robert Lai. Dr. Lai came to the United States in 1965 and obtained his PhD in fluid mechanics at Northwestern University. Dr. Lai started out his career as a professor of civil engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee from 1970 to 1980. He then moved to Maryland as a senior professional staff at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, before settling down at TRW, where he retired as a senior system engineer in 2000. Having specialized as a defense analyst, he was invited to join Taiwan's National Applied Research Laboratories in 2003, and as board of director, and later served as chairman of the board from 2006 to 2008. It is my distinct honor now to welcome Chairman Dr. Robert Lai.
Good morning. The congressman has not arrived yet. Ambassador Gao and AID Managing Director, Mr. Norris. And distinguished speakers, our fellow GTI's co-founders and board of directors, advisors, counselors, and friends. As chairman of GTI, allow me to extend my warm welcome to everybody to this GTI's first inaugural symposium. It's a wonderful feeling to be able to reconnect some of old friends and meet some new friends here today. Just a year ago, GTI launched an opening reception in our office at Jefferson Place, just south of DuPont Circle. It's only 1 year since we became a new player in Washington, D.C. And now GTI has transformed from a new institute in D.C. to an active and a serious participant in public discussion of Taiwan-U.S. relations. In short 12-month period, GTI has made some important impact of better understanding Taiwan and the U.S. in general. I think this has been recognized both in D.C. and in Taipei. Now, this accomplishment of GTI in such a short period of time would not be possible without the support of GTI's co-founders and the board of directors. They are faced to deepening the relations of U.S. and Taiwan, made them commit their hard-earned resources to this matter. I'd like to take this opportunity particularly to commend our executive director, Russell Hsiao, and his team. Their excellent work make this thing possible. So GTI, as is today, I think is relatively well recognized its existence. I remember last year, about the same time, we had the opening reception in our office. I made a statement, and I think it's worth repeating. As older generations of Taiwanese Americans, we like to entrust future generations with the responsibility of deepening the relationship between Taiwan and U.S. And I thank Russell and his team validated my belief. So I thank everybody today for support of GTI, and looking forward to continuing joint effort on strengthening the relations between U.S. and Taiwan. Thank you for coming, and God bless U.S. and God bless Taiwan. Enjoy the symposium.
Now it is my privilege to introduce our opening remarks by Ambassador Stanley Gao. Ambassador Gao is the representative to the United States at the Taipei Economic and Representative Office in Washington, D.C. Prior to his current appointment, Representative Gao was the ROC representative to Italy from 2013 to 2016, as well as representative to Hungary from 2008 to 2010. From 2004 to 2007, he served as deputy representative to the United States. Other posts include Director General for Economic Affairs and International Cooperation, Deputy Representative of the ROC to the WTO, and Director of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs North America Division. He has served as the English interpreter for President Chen Shui-bian and President Li Denghui. From 1996 to 1997, he was a fellow at the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs at Harvard University. He holds an MA in International Law and Diplomacy from National Zhengzhou University and a BA in Political Science from National Taiwan University. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Gao.
Well, thank you very much, Russell, for that very generous and gracious introduction. And thank you very much for having me on behalf of the Taipei Representative Office here in Washington, D.C. But first of all, let me commend and congratulate the GTI. I mean, making all this tireless and wonderful work and promoting the U.S.-Taiwan relations and bring attention to issues related to the Taiwan to the Washington policy community, and your brilliant leadership, Dr. Robert Lai, and of course, also with the enthusiastic support and bold vision of the board members, and of course, the Russell Shell's excellent team that made it all possible. And what a job. You know, well done. Congratulations. And I understand that today's symposium was centered on U.S., Taiwan, and this really most reliable economic and equally indispensable economic and security partnership, and also Taiwan's role as a responsible stakeholder and a key player in the regional and geopolitical context. But I think it's all, of course, I cannot wait to hear your stimulating and really inspiring discussion and intellectual exercise. But I think this relationship, bilateral relationship, is more than, of course, economic and security. It's all about a goodwill, about solidarity, and of course, a lot of friendship. I think when Hurricane Harvey just started pounding Texas and Louisiana and causing casualties and the damages, I think my president, Dr. Tsai Ing-wen, was among the first world leaders to express her thoughts and prayers with the people down there. And because she remembers so well, just 6 months ago, she made a transit stop over in that part of USA, and all the most gracious hospitality, impeccable arrangements, and based on the principle of comfort, convenience, safety, and dignity, accorded to her and her delegation. And so immediately after her Twitter message, my government pledged $800,000 cash donation to the victims, the families, and as part of the relief efforts. And just 2 days ago here in Washington, I presented a check to American Red Cross headquarters. And that's the first check the organization ever received from any foreign country. So $800,000, $500,000 going to the Red Cross, another $300,000 going directly to the Houston city government. The sum may be small, but our heart is much, much bigger, you know, whatsoever. So this is what I mean by, and I must also understand that the Taiwanese community down in Texas, now in Florida, and Chamber of Commerce, religious groups, and charitable organizations continue to mobilize the volunteers to help collect and distribute food, hot meals, water, blankets to the shelters and try to be of any help to the people now in need. So this is what we talk about, you know, friend indeed, friend in need. But so this is in terms of U.S.-Taiwan relations and against all odds. This is what we believe. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. And so this brings us back to what Secretary Rex Tillerson had to say, you know, during her confirmation hearing exactly this time, 8 months ago, when he said that the Taiwan Relations Act, of course, being the cornerstone of our robust relationship, but that special piece of legislation is, on the one hand, a legal commitment, the U.S. to Taiwan, but also such a moral imperative. And he also stressed, reaffirming, and he also stressed that, and I quote, "The people of Taiwan is our friends and should not be treated in any way as a bargaining chip." What a powerful, clear message. So this is where we believe we have so much at stake. And as you know very well, to forge this very important relationship based on our shared core values, our common interest, and a strong bipartisan support, my president, President Tsai Ing-wen, and her team actually has been sticking to her leadership and decision-making style, just like the way he manages so many domestic reform agenda, cross-trade relations, and Taiwan's international participation. Focused, consistent, persistent, non-provocative, and no-nonsense. But flexible and creative, you know, as necessary, but without bowing to any external pressure. So with that, we feel very confident and equally comfortable. I think I probably, some of our friends still remember the old Smith Barney commercial about making money the old-fashioned way. You earn it. And here we believe, you know, through our mutual trust and our joint efforts, we should be able to weather the storm together and pursue the partnership and the friendship and to earn this strong relationship. So thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to seeing you tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador Gao, for your kind remarks. I'm Jennifer Hu, and I'm a vice chair of the Global Taiwan Institute. On behalf of our co-founders, board members, and staff, I want to echo the warm welcome offered by our chair, Dr. Robert Lai. We're truly delighted to have all of you join us today for our inaugural annual symposium on U.S.-Taiwan policy. We're especially honored to be joined by our keynote speaker, Congressman Ron DeSantis, who represents the 6th District of Florida and is a good friend of Taiwan. Congressman DeSantis, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here. Our thoughts and prayers are with the people of Florida who are recovering from Hurricane Irma. Congressman DeSantis is a graduate of Yale University and Harvard Law School. While at Harvard, he was commissioned as a JAG officer in the U.S. Navy and deployed to Iraq, where he served as advisor to a Navy SEAL commander. His exemplary service earned him a Bronze Star, a Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal, and the Iraq Campaign Medal. In the course of his career, he also served both as a federal and a military prosecutor. He's currently a lieutenant commander in the reserve component of the U.S. Navy. Congress DeSantis was elected to Congress in 2013, and he has been a steadfast advocate for a strong national security policy. As chairman of the National Security Subcommittee and as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, he has emphasized the importance of supporting key partners like Taiwan. He co-sponsored House Resolution 494 to affirm the importance of the U.S.-Taiwan relations. The importance of Taiwan Relations Act, demonstrating his support for stronger U.S.-Taiwan relations. He has also consistently pursued policies that enhance peace and security in the Asia-Pacific region, which is in the national interest of both the U.S. and Taiwan. Thank you, Congressman DeSantis, for your support and friendship to Taiwan, and for joining us as we celebrate GTI's first anniversary. And so please join me in extending a warm welcome to Congressman DeSantis.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate what you guys are doing. Thank you for the introduction and for the concern for what's going on in Florida. I think all things being equal, I think Florida dodged a bullet in terms of how the storm hit. There are some places that were hit very badly, like the Florida Keys. It's going to be tough for those folks. But for most of the other parts of the state, from what it could have been a week ago to what happened, I think we're going to be able to recover and be back at it. So looking to do a symposium down in Florida, keep those plans or make those plans. We're open. We're going to be open for business. You know, my first kind of exposure or involvement or interest in Taiwan was not when I was in the Congress or even when I was in college or studying different things about foreign affairs. My first interest in Taiwan goes back to Little League Baseball when I was a kid. And if you remember at that time, this is in the, I was a Little League All-Star 1990-91. So if you go back and look throughout the 80s and into the early 90s, the dominant power in Little League Baseball was Chinese Taipei. And, you know, it wasn't even that they won a lot, but, you know, they would go out there and they would really dismantle a lot of the competition. And it wasn't always pretty for some of the American teams. And they even beat teams that had future major leaguers who ended up being very good. So, you know, we're 12 years old. We see this. We're in a little small city in Florida called Dunedin, but we had visions of going to the Little League World Series. And so before the season started, we put underneath the bill of our hats, WWT, we want Taiwan. And that was our goal. And it turns out that, you know, we started going, you win your district, then you win, you know, in a big state like Florida, there's different sections of the state, you win that tournament, And then we win the state of Florida, and we're the Florida state champions. And then we have 13 teams in the Southern Regional, all 13 states from Texas to Virginia and south from there. And we win that and get a ticket to the Little League World Series. And so we got to, so you had four American teams, four foreign teams. The Taiwan represented the Far East. You had the Dominican Republic, who was very good representing Latin America. So we got to interact with the Taiwanese players. We got to watch how they approach the game. We did not get to play them because we lost to California in the first round. Taiwan beat Dominican Republic in a very close game, and Taiwan ended up winning. But we were able to make some friendships, playing ping pong, playing catch, doing all that. And, you know, what stuck with me about that experience is, these were kids just like us. I mean, they loved baseball, and they really shared a lot of the same values as we did. And so that's something, that experience is something that I take with me here, because I think when you start talking about the relationship between the United States and Taiwan, it's a relationship rooted not just in shared interests, but also in shared values. And I think when you have both of those working in harmony, that is a relationship that you must protect and defend. There's a lot of relationships we have throughout the world that we have aligned interests with another country. And I'm somebody who's realistic about this stuff, and I say you need to work with that. I mean, you look at some of the people we work with to fight terrorism, like the Egyptian government. I give them high marks for being 100% on the right side against radical Islamic terrorism. You know, I don't know that their civil society is exactly what we would want in America. So we have shared interests. The values may not necessarily be aligned there. I still think I think it's smart to work with them, and I think that they are a good ally in this. And you have some other countries that are more in the line of kind of liberal democratic traditions, but I'd say they've gone off the deep end a little bit on some of their policies. I think in some countries in Europe. So again, we have come from a similar tradition, so we work well with them. But I think when you look at a country like Taiwan, not only the importance of having a strategic ally in the Far East that's important, obviously having I think we need to have a closer, military relationship, but Taiwan is really the one country in that outpost that's really at the tip of the spear defending freedom, democracy, the rule of law, and free market, free enterprise. And the results, I think, really speak for themselves. If you look at how successful Taiwan is operating within the context of a free society, and you compare that to other places in the region, even some places where you have some economic success, you don't have a free press, you don't have the ability for citizens to participate and exercise their liberties, I think the experience of Taiwan speaks for itself. You know, Taiwan is a key economic partner with the United States. Taiwan is the seventh largest recipient of American agriculture exports. A lot of people don't know that. It's a relatively small country, and yet that's a huge boon to the American agriculture industry. We have a lot of agriculture in Florida, but obviously throughout the rest of our country, it's very, very important. And Taiwan is the 10th trading partner in terms of the volume of trade that we do. And they're responsible for creating that trading relationship's responsible for creating hundreds of thousands of jobs here in the United States. And so a lot of times people will look at the relationship with Taiwan and say, we do a lot to defend them, we pledge to defend Taiwan, but Taiwan's doing a lot to benefit the United States of America, and I think it's important to understand that. It is very, very important that our commitment to Taiwan be unshakable, and that the whole world knows that the United States will stand by Taiwan. And part of it is because you need to do that. It's in our interest to do that. But part of the reason we do it is it's just the right thing to do. It's the right thing to be supporting people
who share our values and are doing things the right way. And I remember when during the presidential transition, when President Trump took the call, you know, a lot of people, oh my gosh, and the media were doing that. Look, I thought that was the right thing to do. You know, we shouldn't be shy about wanting to have a strong relationship with Taiwan. And the thing is for all that Taiwan is doing, for all that they've done right, you know, that American support is vital for Taiwan's continued viability. I mean, you just can't walk away from Taiwan and think that somehow Taiwan is going to end up, everything's going to be hunky-dory. And so if you want to have a strong partner in that part of the world, if you want to foster freedom, democracy, and the rule of law, then the relationship needs to remain strong. Look, I think you look at what's going on in the region, and a lot of times with the North Korea issue, you have a lot of focus, obviously, on South Korea and Japan, who are two strong allies. But, you know, look, missile defense capability, you know, we should consider providing Taiwan with missile defense capability. I think they need it. I think that they're in a dangerous region. I would expand our military relationship with Taiwan, you know, as much as we can, because I think that will end up deterring a lot of threats to have a stronger military relationship and have America projecting more military power vis-a-vis defense of Taiwan. So these are all really, really important things. And, you know, I think that the current president understands the importance of Taiwan instinctively. I worry a little bit about some of the bureaucracy kind of exerting its will in different bowels of our federal government sometimes, because they don't always want to do the right thing. Sometimes they look for the path of least resistance. But you got to do what's right. You got to stand up for what's right. It's in our interest to do so, and it's the right thing to do. So I'm an ally in the Congress. We have a number of other people who are strong allies in the Congress. I noticed on your advisory board, you have one of my former colleagues, Matt Salmon, who I work closely with on these issues when he was in the Congress with me the last two terms. He's moved on to greener pastures, but very, very glad to see him helping out this organization. And once I saw that, I mean, I knew that you guys are certainly on the right path to doing what's right. So it's an honor to be here. I mean, I'm happy to take any questions if you guys want to take any questions. But just understand that there's a group of us in the Congress who are going to be steadfast supporters of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship and who understand the importance in a number of respects. Yes.
Yeah, Congressman, I'm Tina Chung with Voice of America's China branch. My question is on the 2018 NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act. There are elements calling for stronger U.S.-Taiwan military exchanges. What's your view on that? You support that? And how do you think the administration would support, especially with regard to the port call?
So I 100% support the military exchanges, and you know, would like to see those grow. And then you said the port call. I mean, what's that? Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm in favor of that. I mean, I think that that's something that we need to do, and we shouldn't. You know, we shouldn't act like somehow that we shouldn't have. We shouldn't have strong relationships there. So I would be in favor of doing that.
Representative, my name is Ben Lawson. I'm a Navy Asia strategist. I'd just like to ask you if you've seen or how you feel about Senator Gardner's Asia strategy bill.
I have not seen it. I have heard about it. And it's something that, you know, if that's something that gets teed up in one of our committees, obviously we'll be looking at it very closely. I did, though, I will say that a number of members in my house who recently traveled during one of our recesses to Taiwan for the first time, you know, all came back really, really impressed with what they saw. In fact, we were just talking about that the other day, just on the House floor. So this is never kind of far from people's minds, and I think that that's proof in the pudding. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I just have a quick question. If you have a chance to play baseball with the Taiwan again, will you do that?
Well, you know, we do a thing every year here, the congressional baseball game. And when I got elected, I was 33, 34 when I got elected. I showed up, and I was the toast of the town in some ways with Republican members because they had found out that I had a baseball background. You know, I played all the way through college. And so they're like, oh, we need you for the congressional baseball game. But what you find out, I mean, it's real baseball. It's not anything, not that it's a high level of baseball. But when you haven't played in a while and you go out there and think you can do what you can do, it doesn't necessarily work out that way. So, I mean, I got nicked up pretty good just going out to practice and stuff like that. So I had not played, the last few years. And this year, like, look, we need you to come out. So I'm like, all right, I'll do it. And, many of you heard what had happened. The practice before the baseball game, we were in Alexandria, Virginia, and we had a gunman open fire on our practice. And so it was a really, really searing experience. Our majority whip was grievously wounded. I mean, he's recovering and is gonna survive, which is great. And he's a strong guy. But, we ended up on the heels of that, I think we got like 25,000 people to come to the game at the Nationals Park, and we outdrew, I think, a number of major league teams. Not telling you that the quality of play was that good. I mean, so if you have kind of Taiwanese baseball players who are over the hill, bring them over, we'll have fun. But we try to get, if you get those guys that are playing every day, I think they'd make mincemeat out of us.
I'm sorry, we just have time for one more question, so before we move on to the first panel. Any last questions?
Well, it's not politically viable, I'll say that much. The Trump administration has said, Trump himself has said, they won't develop.
Jeanette Jiang, China Times. You just mentioned that Americans should provide Taiwan more missile defense. Can you say it more about how Americans can do that? Because I remember back to maybe 10 or 20 years ago, Americans actually deferred Taiwan doing that.
Right. No, look, I absolutely. But I think that the region has changed. I think the threats are different now. And our missile defense capability is much different now. It was not really talked about when North Korea is doing these tests. But, I think we are ahead of where they are in terms of our ability to defend against those strikes. Now, you don't want to get to the point where they're actually loading up a nuclear warhead on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile and shooting it. I mean, that's as high stakes as it gets. But we've done a really good job with missile defense. I think we're ahead of where they are now. I think we got to continue to invest to make sure we're ahead of where they are now. But I think what it would do, the more it's deployed with our allies in the region, is I think it would be a strong deterrent effect, because the last thing you want to do is launch a strike, that strike be neutralized, and then there's an overwhelming response. That is not something that I think a Kim Jong-un would want. And one of the reasons I think he started further escalating was when he did see us do a successful missile defense test. This was several months ago. I think that really rattled him. So I think this is good. Wanted for our allies, I wanted it to be in the Czech Republic and in Poland to guard there. And so I would be in favor of deploying that. So I think times have changed. Now it'll cause some friction with some folks in the region. I get that. But at the end of the day, some of these countries that would object to it aren't doing enough to help us neutralize the threat of Kim Jong-un and what he's doing. And so maybe that'll actually put more pressure on countries like China to actually step up and solve this problem, because it's not being solved right now. And I think you got a guy who's in charge of North Korea who, I've said before, he was born into this family, Had he been born somewhere else, he could be in someone's basement eating Cheetos and playing video games. I mean, this is not a statesman. He's there because of accident of birth. He's immature. He's plump. And I think he'd be prone to make a miscalculation. So, yes, you say, why would he want to do that knowing his country would be destroyed? Maybe he understands that. I hope he understands that. But we don't really know what he understands. We don't have enough information on the regime. We don't have enough information on him. This is not the type of guy that you want to have that type of material. And regardless of whether he would use it or not, I am confident he's willing to transfer that technology to rogue regimes in exchange for cash, which his regime needs. So you look at a country like Iran, they may not even need to develop a nuclear weapon domestically. They may be able to get it from Kim Jong-un. So I think the stakes are very high, and I think fortifying our allies with the missile defense, I think could be good tactically, but I think it could also be good strategically. So I'm in favor of it. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Let me know if I can be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you to our opening speakers, and we're going to transition to our first panel now. Thank you.
I'll bother you again on future China, Northeast Asia.
Yeah, feel free. I'm around.
Have a good one.
All right, thanks, Matthew.
Bye.
Oh,
it's a
push.
Sorry.
Except for not the closest one to the podium.
Come on. Are you sitting on that? I'll sit right next to you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Congressman DeSantis, for those very thoughtful and genuine remarks. The first panel of today's symposium is on U.S. grand strategy and Taiwan's role in the Indo-Pacific. Today's symposium will cover a range of core issues related to U.S.-Taiwan relations, the purpose of which is to establish a baseline on which we may systematically assess the progress or regression within this relationship. This is the big picture panel. The scope of this opening panel is to look at the past, present, and future of U.S. grand strategy as it relates to Asia, and specifically how Taiwan fits in it before, now, and into the future. The following panels will address specifics in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, but before we talk about specifics in terms of the different roles that Taiwan plays in U.S. strategy, political, security, and economic, we first need to define what goals those strategies, when combined, serve. Those aggregate goals and the means to achieve them is what I would loosely call a grand strategy. I'm sure that Mike will correct me, but I think we need to start off with a very basic definition of it. And I think a grand strategy is a coordinated plan and set of policies to use American power through political, military, diplomatic, and economic tools for broader national goals. I think while experts will certainly quibble about details, I think we can all agree that grand strategy can and naturally does change over time. And this has clearly been the case for the United States. Mike meticulously captured those profound changes in the United States' grand strategy towards Asia with his new book, Beyond Providence, which I must add really inspired the topic of today's panel, in which he discussed how priorities influenced by both domestic and international consideration and what he aptly described as the five tensions affected how U.S. leaders saw and pursued U.S. national interests as each defined it. While the range for this panel is broad, the scope is narrowed by the fact that this panel will largely analyze the external variables affecting U.S. grand strategy. The end of the Cold War, China's rising, America's relative decline. Are we, as some IR theorists contend, on the cusp of another power transition? If so, how does the reemergence of China, simultaneously with the rise of democracies such as India, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, affect the power transition that some see taking place in the region? Priorities in the absence of clearly articulated, coherent goals can also affect grand strategy. The Trump administration has clearly made North Korea its number one priority. But beyond that, there is still public uncertainty in terms of the role of values and alliances in U.S. strategy towards Asia. And just as U.S. strategy has had to respond to changing dynamics in the region, so does Taiwan's role in it necessarily evolve over time. From a Japanese colony to a rapidly developing economy under martial law, Taiwan now has emerged as a robust market economy with a thriving democracy, centrally located in a dynamic geographic space, a space fraught with tensions, but also abundant opportunities that many observers believe will be the epicenter of the 21st century. To help us make sense of all these meta trends and how Taiwan fits in it for the United States, I'm very pleased to present this panel's speakers. To my far left is Michael Green, who is the Senior Vice President for Asia and Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Chair in Modern and Contemporary Japanese Politics and Foreign Policy at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He served on the staff of the National Security Council from 2001 to 2005, first as Director for Asian Affairs with responsibility for Japan, Korea, Australia, and New Zealand, and then as Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and Senior Director for Asia with responsibility for East Asia and South Asia. To his right, we have Toshi Yoshihara, who is the Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Before joining CSBA, Toshi held the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Area Studies at the U.S. Naval War College, where he taught strategy for over a decade. He was also an affiliate member of the China Maritime Studies Institute at the War College. He is also a member of our advisory board. To his right, we have Daniel M. Kilman. He is a senior fellow at the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Dr. Kilman is also an officer in the U.S. Navy Reserve. Before joining CNAS, Dr. Kilman worked in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, where he served as senior advisor for Asia integration. He was a principal Asia expert for development and implementation of the third offset strategy and executed multiple international engagements focused on defense innovation. He also advised DOD leadership on maritime security issues. He's also the author of a fantastic new book looking at power transitions, and we're very happy to have him on the panel here today. Last but not least, to my immediate left is Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades, most recently in Shanghai, as counsel to the American law firm Paul Weiss, and earlier in Hong Kong as partner in the international law firm Baker & McKenzie. He has appeared on Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network, CNN, countless news networks. It's hard to turn on the TV today and not find Gordon on one of the news major networks. And he also is a member of our advisory board. The format of all the panels today will start with brief presentations by each speaker for about 10 to 12 minutes, then followed by a moderated Q&A, and we'll open up a Q&A after. Mike, the microphone, well, the floor is yours.
Thank you. thank you, Russell, for inviting us. Thanks for your leadership in this new institute, and to Dr. Lai and your board for really making a big mark in Washington and in the debates about Asia, not just about Taiwan. I think that's really the key to the success you've had, is that you're framing Taiwan's importance to the United States in terms of broader strategic interests, values, economic interests. The congressman early illuminated those very effectively, I thought. And so in that spirit, I'll try to offer some framing remarks about American grand strategy and how Taiwan fits. And I'm not going to summarize my book. You gave me an opportunity to do that a few weeks ago. You're going to have to buy the book, especially the Georgetown students. You are in particular going to have to buy the book and be tested on it. So let me just offer some remarks on the debates I see right now about grand strategy as we go into the first year of the Trump administration. Grand strategy is not some objectively measurable and perfectly attained thing. It's contested, it's debated, and particularly in a democracy like the United States, there is no singular sort of consistent grand strategy. There are some key themes that I trace in my book, most important of which is that the United States has, for all of our distractions and dysfunctionality, always acted using our instruments of power to prevent a rival hegemon from dominating Asia and the Pacific and keeping us out. That's a through line that's been consistent, and I think will be consistent again with the rise of China. But how you do that and how you frame your strategy is going to be debated and is debated today. And I see, broadly speaking, three schools of thought, which are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but which are all evident in the current administration in one way or another, and all of which have implications for how the United States thinks about Taiwan strategically. So the first broad line of thinking would argue that the U.S. and China, to manage this shifting power relationship, have got to reach some kind of grand bargain. And the most visible and promoted version of this right now is Graham Allison's book, The Thucydides Trap, which is very popular in Beijing, which Xi Jinping quotes quite a bit, particularly, I'm told, in internal meetings. And the thesis, of course, is that when there's a power transition, according to Professor Allison and his team, more often than not, the rising power fights a war with the status quo power. And therefore, to avoid that tragic future in U.S.-China relations, we have to reach a bargain now and accommodate China's power. And it assumes a linear projection of Chinese power, which is not necessarily right. And the biggest flaw in the logic is it ignores Asia as a whole. And it sort of frames this power transition as a U.S.-China bipolar dynamic and ignores the importance of Taiwan, of course, but also Japan and India and Korea. It sets aside any attention to values. It ignores geography, and in particular the importance of the First Island Chain, and the fact that it's very popular in Zhengzhouhai in itself should cause us a bit of pause. So I would say in the sort of think tank in the swamp that about 2-3 years ago, if you voted in think tanks, the new model of great power relations, Xinjin, Daguo, Guanxi, this idea that we need this, I would bet it would get about half of the Asia experts in town saying that's a good idea. My guess is right now you get about 10% support. I think it's been largely discredited, but it's still out there. And you could see evidence of this when the Trump administration put a hold on freedom of navigation operations, Taiwan arms sales, in the hope that the timeout would lure China to be more cooperative on North Korea. I think that was also, that effort was also discredited, but the idea is still out there. The second emerging line of thinking is that we are now in a existential competition with China. And that we need to organize the United States strategy, not just militarily, but in terms of economic strategy, information, the whole dime spectrum, diplomatic, information, military, and economic. We need to align our whole strategy for an existential competition with China. And we need to go head-to-head with China. If they're mercantilist, we need to pursue economic strategies that counter that. This approach, I think, is gaining in credibility, in part because the previous Obama administration, in my view, embraced the first approach too much, and so the debate swung in the other direction. But this also has in it, this second approach, some flawed logic. It also, in an ironic way, is premised on a bipolar structure of power in Asia, and doesn't take full account of the important role of major powers in the region like Japan and India, Korea and Australia. And the danger of a pure blue on red competition is defections. Defections at home, because how do you mobilize the business communities, state governors for this zero-sum competition? And defections in Asia, how do you keep Korea, Australia, even Japan on board? And so it's got merit, and particularly in the areas Dan worked on, military competition, we are in a serious competition. We need to invest in the third offset. We need to prepare for different kinds of war-winning strategies and deterrence. But as a comprehensive grand strategy, it's got its undersides and limits, too, that we're just discovering. The third approach, which I have been affiliated most with, is the idea that Rich Armitage and Joe Nye expressed in the famous Armitage-Nye reports in 2000, but also in 2007, and I was part of that group with Kurt Campbell and I think some other people in this room, the argument was to get China strategy right, you have to get Asia right. And you have to position yourself with strong alliances and strong partnerships. Taiwan is central to that. And that will give you a better position. It rejects bipolarity and embraces, in a way, the rising multipolarity in Asia. And in my book, I talk quite a bit about historically Theodore Roosevelt, John Quincy Adams, we've actually been pretty good at using multipolarity in Asia to our advantage. It minimizes the risks of defections. It's far more effective when you're trying to shape the strategic environment, reinforce values and rules and norms. But this strategic approach also has its limits, and we're finding this in the era of Xi Jinping with the South China Sea power grab, the creation of these air bases, the closing of civil society space, not only in China, but with Chinese reach into Hong Kong, Mongolia, and even Taiwan, and in some ways, even the United States and Australia. And so this strategic approach I would still endorse, but it needs updating, and it needs some elements of the other two approaches. So I think that's kind of where the debate is. And to conclude, Taiwan is going to be central to how we formulate this strategy. I don't think the Trump administration has settled on a grand strategy. I think all three elements have been very pronounced in different, you know, periods of this administration. Already in just 7 months, we've seen all three. The national security strategy that every administration does is supposed to come out from the White House early next year. We'll see how they square these. I would conclude, though, by arguing that in all three approaches, if we think about them and sort of take the best of each, and in particular the last one, Taiwan's going to be central. And I would put it this way, that there are three things in our broad strategy that should be non-negotiable as we deal with China. One is geography. We have never and we will not cede the first island chain. And Toshi's the man on this, and I hope we'll say more about the geography of Western Pacific grand strategy. And Taiwan, of course, is central to that and links directly to the security of Japan, the credibility of the U.S.-Japan alliance. But in historical and geopolitical terms, the first and second island chains are how we keep the Pacific open and secure, but not only the Pacific, but the Indian Ocean now. And Taiwan's in the middle of that. So that's not something we will negotiate away in some grand bargain. We have to think how we reinforce Taiwan's defense and our security relationships to secure the first and second island chains. Second, our values and rules. We're not going to cede our commitment to an open, rules-based order in the Asia-Pacific region. And how Taiwan is treated by China and how Taiwan is treated by the U.S. and other partners is going to be a key part of that, particularly as we look at trade and rulemaking. The administration, I think almost everyone who works on Asia would agree, shot itself in the foot by pulling out of TPP, but I don't think that strategic game is over, and Taiwan's role in an open Pacific and Trans-Pacific trading framework and rulemaking process is critical. And third, what is non-negotiable in our strategy should be coercion. That China's use of coercion to advance its interests, particularly in the Western Pacific, but not only in the Western Pacific, should be unacceptable. And there again, Taiwan is critical. So in all three of these areas, as we build our strategy, Taiwan is going to have to be at the center of it. And I know that Gordon and Dan and also Toshi have done a lot of work on some of the specifics, and I'll turn it over for more details.
Thanks. Toshi?
Thanks, Russell. I will, in fact, build on Mike's talk to talk more specifically about the role of geography and Taiwan's place in Asia's maritime geography to highlight its importance. So to discuss Taiwan's strategic importance in the Indo-Pacific, what I'd like to do is start by framing it in terms of enduring U.S. aims in Asia. And I believe that the United States has consistently sought two broad objectives since the end of World War II. And they're interrelated and they reinforce each other. And they are, to put it very simply, access and power. Now, let me start with access. Folks in my field in strategic studies tend to talk about access in very narrow terms, in terms of military access. But I think access should be understood in much broader terms. Access stands for economic, diplomatic, cultural, political, even ideational access, including the exchange of ideas and values. And of course, access flows both ways, just as Asian nations, including Taiwan, would like to have access to the vast American market. However, military access and the ability to wield hard power through that access underwrite these other peacetime forms of access. Hard power keeps access open should deterrence fail, and hard power, of course, keeps the peace that facilitates and encourages the other forms of peacetime access. Now, let me talk about the second part of the equation, which is power. In particular, the United States has consistently sought to maintain a favorable balance of power along the eastern seaboard of the Eurasian landmass since the end of World War II. The term favorable, of course, is a relative, subjective concept. It's favorable specifically to the United States. But I would argue that what's been favorable to the United States in Asia has been largely favorable to everyone else across Asia, except for countries like North Korea. Now, maintaining a favorable balance of power has required alliances, partnerships, a constellation of forward bases, a preponderance of military power, including the ability to project power across vast distances. And as I mentioned, power and access are mutually dependent. A favorable balance of power enables access, while access, which brings with it productivity and wealth and the revenues and resources to maintain that favorable balance of power, you can see how those two interact with each other in a virtuous cycle. What I'd like to do, though, is to focus on the latter part of the equation, on power, the idea of a favorable balance of power in Asia as a starting point for thinking about Taiwan's strategic importance in the Indo-Pacific. In particular, I want to anchor my discussion in terms of geography and strategy. And that is because geography is a basic unit of measurement for assessing power, for assessing the power balance, and for assessing the conditions of what constitutes a favorable balance. Now, I know geography, geostrategy, and geopolitics seems a little bit old-fashioned. It's very 19th century, if you will, especially in the age of the information revolution, cosmopolitanism, and transnationalism, etc. But I want to emphasize Taiwan's continuing importance as a strategic location, as a strategic space. And in my view, its continuing geostrategic importance will continue to influence great power politics in Asia. In particular, the confluence of Chinese, American, and Japanese interests over the strategic space. And I think that will continue to be a determinant of regional stability and security. Whether we like it or not, I think Taiwan will remain a front line of geopolitics in Asia. So let me start with the United States first in thinking about the convergence of these three powers. Now, you've all heard of the tired metaphors about Taiwan as an unsinkable aircraft carrier or Taiwan serving as a cork in the bottle of the South China Sea. But I think Taiwan has to be understood in the larger strategic context, particularly the Cold War context. As you'll recall, at the beginning of the Cold War, Japan and the Philippines served as the northern and southern anchors of America's defense perimeter of the Pacific. That perimeter inched forward westward to include South Korea after the Korean War broke out. It inched forward again towards Taiwan after the 1954 Taiwan Strait crisis, and that line extended to the dividing line between North and South Vietnam. What we saw then, of course, in the latter phases of the Cold War was how that configuration of power began to change. We retracted that line after we withdrew from South Vietnam in 1973. We retracted further in the 70s after we left Taiwan, and of course, we left the Philippines in 1992. So to this day, the bulk of our forward presence outside of U.S. territory is concentrated in Northeast Asia, primarily in South Korea and in Japan. Now, when the Chinese talk about the so-called first island chain that Mike mentioned, which is, of course, the line of islands running from Japan through Taiwan through the Philippines, they're not referring to some abstract operational line for the Chinese Navy. What they're referring to is the architecture of American military power and the core alliance relations and partnerships that exist along that transnational archipelago. That's what they're talking about. That's what concerns them. And when they talk about the first, the second, or the third island chains, the second referring to the Marianas centered on Guam, or the third being the Hawaii Islands centered on Pearl Harbor, they are referring to concentric rings of American military power that stretches from the American homeland right into what the Chinese consider to be their backyard. This structure of American military power, I think, is integral to our understanding of power and of maintaining a favorable balance of power in Asia. Let me now turn to China. Chinese strategists frequently talk about the benefits of possessing China in geostrategic terms. Taiwan is considered a potential gateway to the Pacific. It allows Chinese forces to break out, quote unquote, into the Pacific. Taiwan would free up China's ability to move freely along the coast and free up the north-south movement of their forces. Conversely, the status quo means that Taiwan is the midpoint along the first island chain, the central sentinel along the Great Wall in reverse, which of course threatens to hem China in. There's a real sense of claustrophobia, I think, in the minds of Chinese when they look out into the Western Pacific. Now, here's one evocative way to think about the intersection of Chinese and American geostrategic interests. Imagine drawing an arc that starts from the southern tip of Hainan Island and draw that arc up through the east coast of Taiwan, and that arc terminates at the tip of Shandong Peninsula. That arc would represent, to Chinese eyes, the natural maximum extension of China's seaward-facing territories, a kind of a natural maritime defense perimeter that allows China to potentially support, mutually support each other along that long frontier. Without Taiwan, then, China's perimeter and extension to the seas would be incomplete. Now draw that line, draw that arc, and then draw the line down the first island chain. Where do those two lines intersect? Taiwan. Let me now add briefly Japan's perspective. By dint of geographic proximity, it is hard to disentangle Taiwan's security from Japan's security and vice versa. Recall the March 1996 Chinese missile test during the height of the Cross-Strait crisis. The northern missile splash zone just off of Keelung was uncomfortably close to the southern end of the Southwest Islands. And I looked this up on Google just to make sure that I got the coordinates right. The southeast corner of the square-shaped splash zone just off of Keelung was 60 kilometers from Yonaguni Island. Think, too, about the surge in Chinese air operations recently, including H-6 bombers, electronic warfare aircraft, reconnaissance aircraft, flying off the east coast of Taiwan by way of the Miyako Strait in August. So again, that goes to underscore how really the security of Taiwan and Japan should be thought of as an integrated unit. Let me now step back and ask you to think about Asia's maritime geography. So to step back again and to look at the map more broadly. I think we have a tendency to compartmentalize the individual bodies of water into discrete, independent bodies of water. So the Sea of Japan is standing on its own, and the South China Sea stands on its own. But I think it's useful to stitch these bodies of water together into an integrated, singular body of water. Try conceiving of those waters as a single ocean, if you will, stretching from the South China Sea through the Taiwan Strait into the East China Sea, up the Yellow Sea, through the Tsushima Strait into the Sea of Japan. Consider that one single water. The water itself is strategically meaningless. What makes this water so important are the countries bounding it. Think of the megalopolises and the great cities that encircle this water, from Tokyo to Osaka to Seoul, from the Bohai Economic Rim to the Yangtze River Delta Economic Zone, to the Pearl River Delta Economic Zone, to Ho Chi Minh City, to Kuala Lumpur, to Singapore, winding its way up through Jakarta to Manila, finally to Kaohsiung and Taipei. It is the productive capacity of this ring of economies, the wealth and power that it's generated, and the military power that it has produced, that makes this singular body of water so strategically significant. As my friend Misha Oslin Hoover has usefully termed it, it's the Asiatic Mediterranean. He argues that whoever controls this body of water controls the course of this region's destiny. And indeed, that's the underlying logic to maintaining a favorable balance of power in Asia for the United States. Now, we've been really accustomed to ruling the waves over this body of water for the past seven decades, but things have been changing. This body of water is becoming ever more competitive, congested, and contested. It wasn't so long ago that the US Navy could sail through these waters without ever running into a Chinese warship, once. Now, Chinese combatants regularly trail our naval patrols. In fact, they welcome us into Chinese waters when we go into the South China Sea. Again, look at the map in your minds. Taiwan borders the narrow waist of this Asiatic Mediterranean. An understanding of this contest for this body of water, particularly between China and the United States, is in essence a contest in the power balance. And that understanding would be incomplete without Taiwan. In conclusion, I think it's important to acknowledge the limits of geography and strategy. They're not a panacea. They won't answer all of the important questions about Taiwan's place in the Indo-Pacific or about US strategy in Asia. But I think it's an essential starting point for thinking about Taiwan's important and enduring place in the Indo-Pacific. Thank you.
Thank you, Toshi. Dan?
Well, first, I want to say congratulations to GTI for putting on this symposium this morning and later this afternoon, and thank all of you. I know you have other places to be. I think everybody turning out this morning is a reflection of the importance of not only the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, but also Asia for America's future prosperity and security. This morning, I want to make three points. One is how China's regime type shapes American grand strategy in the Asia-Pacific. The second point is the special role that democracies have to play in U.S.-France strategy. And the third is that Taiwan's exposure to Chinese power and influence actually in some ways is a strategic asset that it can leverage as other countries across the region and beyond experience a power transition vis-a-vis China. Let me start unpacking the first point. I want to take a step back from current day events and think abstractly for a second about power transitions and why should democracy matter or autocracy. In power transitions, trust is critical. If a rising power is a democracy, its system is transparent. There's freedom of the press. There are many actors who can push out information credibly to outsiders. And so there's a very good sense of what that rising power is about, what are its long-term intentions. At the same time, democracy means that there are many centers of power in a society that can shape foreign policy. So for outsiders, there's always someone to turn to for shaping and access. And so what this means is that for a democracy rising, others can be reassured that they will always at least have some sense of what that rising democracy's intentions are and always be able to find internal players within who at least are like-minded and can shape the foreign policy. This is not the case for autocracies. Autocracies, as they rise, sow mistrust. In an autocracy, there's a lack of transparency. Secrecy pervades an autocracy. The press is unfree. And so there is not credible information about that rising autocracy's long-term intent. At the same time, power is centralized in an autocracy, which means that there aren't competing centers of authority that outsiders can come and link up with and leverage to shape perhaps some of the harder edges of that autocracy's power, of that autocracy's foreign policy as it rises. So what this means in the abstract is that democracies as they rise create less instability. Autocracies, on the other hand, sow mistrust and potentially instability as they gain in power. I want to quickly turn to a historical analogy that this isn't just abstract, but we've seen this happen before in history. If you look at the turn of the 20th century, where Great Britain confronted two rising powers, one was the United States, the other was Imperial Germany. Both had very similar power trajectories, but very distinctive domestic governments. The US, of course, was a democracy, and what that meant was that as it gained in power, Great Britain could essentially cede ground, that it could look into the US system. There was lots of information from a free US press, from many actors in the US political system who all mattered, engaged that America, although prickly, at the end of the day, was not going to be inimical. And at the same time, the British could always find friends in the US, whether it was in the administration, Congress, the business community, and could essentially shave off the hard edges of America's rise. And so from a British perspective, they could accommodate. Essentially, they could reach a grand bargain. With Imperial Germany, the reverse was true. In Germany, power was centralized in the hands of the Kaiser, whose mind was not terribly transparent, who was also somewhat unstable. And so from a British perspective, they couldn't have a good sense of German intent, nor could they find other centers of power in Germany that could offset the Kaiser's instability and antipathy towards Great Britain. And so there was no grand bargain with Germany. Instead, Great Britain had an unstable combination of cooperation and competition that ultimately paved the way for World War I. Turning now to China, we see, although no historical parallel is, of course, perfect, we see a somewhat similar dynamic. China, of course, is not a democracy. It lacks a free press. It's not transparent. Secrecy pervades their system. And what this means, of course, is that it's challenging to understand what is China's long-term intent. At the same time, power is highly centralized, even more so today under Xi Jinping than in the past. And so there are not friendly or like-minded domestic actors, which the US and others can find, work with, to try to mitigate some of the harder edges of Chinese foreign policy. And so what this means for US grand strategy is that there is no grand bargain, and that the US has, really since China's rise began in the late 1990s, had to pair cooperation with competition. Historically, that's not been a stable approach, and I think, as Mike alluded to now, there's a lot of debate on sort of what's the proper balance between these two, and can we successfully balance them going forward? I want to turn now to the second point, which is the special role that democracies play in U.S. grand strategy in Asia. Here, from a U.S. perspective, democracies, because they are transparent and because they are more receptive to external influence, simply make better allies and partners. U.S. strategy in Asia, at times explicitly, at times implicitly, aims to create, I would say, not only a favorable balance of power in general, but a balance of power that favors democracies and knits democracies together. And to give just a quick handful of examples, This could be promoting Japan's emergence as a key regional power, as the cornerstone of American of regional prosperity and security. It could be boosting a key U.S. partner, India, removing impediments to its rise, which has really happened since the nuclear deal under the George W. Bush administration. And then there's a whole host of connecting democracies together, whether it's connecting Japan and Korea with a focus on the North Korea threat, or Japan, Australia, Japan, India, again, creating a democratic network to underpin a rules-based order. Taiwan, of course, is a vibrant democracy, makes an important contribution in this strategy. One is simply that a prosperous and militarily capable Taiwan can help maintain a favorable balance of power for democracies in the region writ large. Taiwan can also play a role to advance democracy in the region, whether it's through helping to build civil society capacity in countries that have yet to undergo a democratic transition, or even promoting women's empowerment, where Taiwan is a regional leader in that area. I want to now turn to the third point, which is that as Chinese power and influence expands, Taiwan's cross-strait relation, experience with cross-strait military and economic dynamics becomes a real strategic asset, and one that is increasingly relevant to both the region and the world. In a sense, Taiwan has some key lessons that it can share with U.S. allies and partners as they also navigate a power transition with China. I'll briefly cover four areas where I believe this is the case. The first is in cybersecurity. Owing to its geopolitical position and also technologically advanced economy, Taiwan is, of course, a primary target of Chinese cyber attacks. Taiwan has begun investing in its cybersecurity through, for example, hardware and software research, as well as innovative policy responses, such as setting up a new military unit to focus on cybersecurity. Taiwan, of course, is not the only democracy or non-democracy to experience Chinese cyber threats. And being at kind of the forefront and experiencing Chinese pressure, it has lessons to share, both in terms of successes and failures, as other nations look to protect their commercial and strategic assets against this type of threat. As a longtime recipient of Chinese economic investment, Taiwan is also well positioned to provide lessons as nations worldwide experience an influx of Chinese money into their economies, often into strategically important sectors. Taiwan's economy, I think as everyone knows here, is tightly connected to China through investment flows, through shared production networks. And protecting Taiwan's technology edge, even as factories have moved to China, opened up research centers there, is an increasing challenge. The current administration in Taiwan has applied more scrutiny and is looking at this challenge, for example, through essentially turning off a few deals on microchip investments this year. Taiwan, of course, is not the only actor to experience the challenge in the United States. There's an influx of Chinese investment, often into critical sectors here. It's an Asian challenge as well. And as Taiwan navigates this challenge, there is an opportunity for dialogue with others who are very much in the same place currently. Economic coercion is another area where Taiwan has lessons it can share. Of course, Taiwan has tried to manage its vulnerability to China's economic coercion, despite a profound degree of economic entanglement. Dependence on China for trade and investment is one challenge for Taiwan, but so is tourism. And Taiwan has made, I would say, remarkable strides in trying to diversify, whether it's approaching Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, or both for pushing external investment in that direction, or in terms of tourism coming to Taiwan. And again, Taiwan is well positioned to share lessons learned. I want to briefly touch on the military dimension here, because I know we'll have a panel this afternoon. But given changes in the cross-strait military balance, if Taiwan moves toward a more asymmetric defense strategy, that's an area where others in the region have lessons to learn as well. Many others in the region increasingly have to contend with a more powerful Chinese military. They don't have the resources to match it through conventional force investments. And so if Taiwan does choose to move in that direction, I think others will be watching keenly to learn from the example it might set. So to conclude, as the United States continues to refine and evolve its grand strategy in Asia, Taiwan can play an important role, not only as a democracy, but also through translating its experience at the crosshairs of Chinese power into lessons learned for countries both in the region and the world. Thank you. Thank you. Take it away.
Russell, I don't know if you're tired of being thanked and congratulated, but let me add the thanks and congratulations of my wife and me. As we just heard from Daniel and also from Mike, if the United States has had a grand strategy for Asia, it's been China. And we see this, of course, in Mike's book. It's all throughout there, and it's crossed centuries. We often see this in this formulation that the U.S.-China relation is the most important bilateral one in the world. And because of that, Americans sometimes forget their values and we accede to much of what Beijing wants. But of course, with a new president, you've got a new approach. And I think that these days you can almost say that the U.S. no longer has a China policy. That's a good thing. It's a good thing in general, and it's a good thing for Taiwan. Indeed, it's intriguing to think about the United States not having a China policy. And part of it is, yes, the president does have policies that affect China, but that doesn't mean he has a China policy. You know, since the end of the Cold War, we've had a focus in Asia of integrating the Chinese Communist superstate into the liberal international system. And indeed, because of presidents, American presidents have implemented this approach. They've often elevated the interests of China over the interests of the United States. And one could say almost that we have a China first policy. But not so Trump. You know, he's come in and he's had one focus for his Asia policy. And really only one focus. And that has been protecting the American homeland from the missiles and nukes of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Now to do that, and Mike, you talked about the various China policies that we look like we've had. And I think you mentioned there were three of them. You know, you had Trump, first of all, starting out with trying to entice China through cooperation. And we saw this in a number of ways. So, for instance, after Trump met Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago in early April, he tweeted out, look, you know, the Chinese can have a much better trade deal if they help us solve North Korea. And because of that, Trump said that basically, you know, things like currency manipulation, Taiwan, freedom of navigation, all of these things really went by the board as the president tried to get the Chinese to help. And perhaps this was most graphically seen in Wilbur Ross's, the Commerce Secretary's, May 11th 10-point plan, which was supposed to reduce our trade deficit with China. But when you start looking at the individual components, they helped China more than anybody else, certainly helped us. So Trump started out with this smother China with love approach. And I think that essentially what we saw was, oh, people said, look, the Chinese have taken over the White House. And indeed, I felt that at the time as well. But I think that that was wrong, because what we were seeing was the president reacting to China in a way that was really focused on North Korea, not on China itself. So when we start to think back of where we are going, we have seen the president sort of pivot. That happened with his famous June 20 tweet when he expressed disappointment with the Chinese. And after that, in the last week of June, we saw all sorts of things that just outraged the Chinese, as they themselves said. One of them, of course, was on Thursday, June 29th, the day which will live forever. The president said that he was going to, he notified Congress of his intention to sell arms to Taiwan in the amount of $1.42 billion. This was a package that the Obama administration had put together, but it had languished under the Trump early months, largely because he was trying to get Beijing's help. That approach, of course, now is over, and we're starting to see things differently. And I believe that Taiwan's going to be a beneficiary of this, because as President looks at China through this North Korea focus, there are irreconcilable differences that I believe are going to grow worse over time. Because we see the Chinese not only with different interests on North Korea, but also doing things that we can't abide. So for instance, they're selling critical equipment to North Korea for its ballistic missile program, probably providing the most advanced missiles to the North Koreans. We see them selling semi-processed fissile material. Big Chinese banks are money laundering for the North Koreans. And of course, the Chinese are hosting North Korean cyber attackers. And those cyber attacks have gone against the United States, as we saw in 2014 with the attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment, and of course, South Korea as well. So as these disagreements with China grow over North Korea, I believe that the United States is going to see Taiwan for what it is. And that is, you know, looking at values, it's the importance of Taiwan as a friend. But you know, as we sort of friend Taiwan, this has already been occurring in the region because China has been putting pressure on countries from its south, going from India, all the way to the South Korea in the northern eastern part of the region. And as that's happened, we have seen the Japanese talk about what Daniel mentioned, and that is values. And this was started early in 2006, where you had, for instance, Foreign Minister Taro Aso talk about an arc of freedom and prosperity. The idea went nowhere because countries were then optimistic about engaging the Chinese and enmeshing the Chinese into the international system of rules, treaties, conventions, and all the rest of it. But these days, of course, as Mike mentioned, there has really been a reassessment of Chinese intentions and what they plan to do for us when they rule the world. So we're seeing countries in the region band together, and most of these countries are democracies, and indeed Taiwan is a central point. Mike talked about geography, so did Toshi. When you think about Japan, our cornerstone alliance, the westernmost inhabited island of Japan is Yonaguni. It's actually south of Taipei, and it's only 58 nautical miles from the east coast of Taiwan. Matter of fact, you can see Taiwan from Japanese soil. And as Arthur Waldron has said many times, this is a strategic unit, Japan and Taiwan, and the Japanese absolutely will not allow the Chinese to have it. And I believe that he's right. This is also an issue, of course, for the United States, because it would be difficult for us to defend Japan if Taiwan was in China's sweaty paws. If we can't defend Japan, then what chance do we have of defending South Korea? So for the United States and for countries around the region, the conclusion is the same. Defending Taiwan is defending their own territory. So as we look out at the general trends in the region, as we look at the reassessment of China, I believe that we are going to see Taiwan being one of the big beneficiaries of the way we now look at the world. And of course, this is far too late. We should have done this much earlier, but it's good that it's happening now. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Gordon. And I think as expected, I think we've really laid out beautifully a great deal to digest here. From Mike establishing a framework for us to sort of analyze the different approaches that the Trump administration has taken towards its Asia strategy, to reconceptualizing geography in the maritime domain in the Asia-Pacific region, to the role of values, to a much larger geostrategic sort of landscape of what are the sort of the variables at play now. What I'd like to do is give the audience a chance to sort of think of their questions. We'll have some time for questions, but I'd like to lead off with a point that Mike raised, and that is the, and Mike, you addressed this extensively in your comments, and this is the idea of a grand bargain. And but I want to give the chance for the other panelists to also sort of weigh in on this issue, and because this is a topic that isn't going away, and that there's been a continuous sort of thread of assessment on how the United States may proceed with a grand bargain, and most sort of recently, some former senior officials have called for a grand bargain with the PRC. Some former presidential campaign advisors who had written also that, and I quote, I can therefore see the emergence of a grand bargain in which the U.S. accepts China's political and social structure and commits not to disrupt it in any way, exchange for China's commitment not to challenge the status quo in Asia, end quote. But not only this former senior official, but also academics who have explicitly tied in Taiwan in the conversation about having a grand bargain, where that academic argued that, quote, ending the U.S. commitment to Taiwan would eliminate the scenario most likely to draw the United States into a large war with China, thus reducing the importance that China places on controlling these sea lane of communications and helping to significantly moderate U.S.-China competition. So I'd like to give a chance for the other speakers to weigh in on what your thoughts are about the sort of the cost of a sort of grand bargain with China in the context of a new U.S. grand strategy, please.
Sure, I guess I'll.
Yeah, did you write that, Dan? Was that your proposal?
Sorry, guys.
I mean, it seems to me that, you know, grand bargain is a sugar-coated way of saying, you know, cutting a deal where we give things to China in exchange for certain things. That's basically what it is, in the most brutally honest way of describing it. And it's not just Graham Allison, but it's Hugh White in Australia, who very explicitly talked about this, both in terms of testing it against his theory about how grand bargains might work. I think it's a bad idea, because what we would be essentially be doing is preemptively giving away things that China may not deserve way ahead of time. And it's based in part on the assumption that Mike talked about, which is that it assumes that China is going to grow very, 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 very strong 10, 20 years from now. And so, under that assumption, we better cut a deal now before China becomes too strong. And so before China becomes too strong, we better cut a deal that locks in our gains and minimizes our losses. But again, as Mike mentioned, it's not clear that China is going to be very, 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 very strong 10, 20 years from now. China's growth is not going to be on this linear upward path forever. I think there's a second problem with this whole notion of the grand bargain. And it's implicit in the grand bargain, which is that we would essentially coerce the smaller players to do what China and the United States want them to do. And it's not clear to me that that's going to be possible. And frankly, it's not the kind of world that I want to live in, where essentially the United States and China, their bumper sticker response to the smaller players would be tough, right? So if Vietnam wanted something, tough, sit down, right? If Taiwan wanted something, tough, sit down. I don't want to live in that world.
Yeah, and Toshi, we've already had an illustration of this. You know, you had Nixon and Kissinger talking to Mao, you know, in 1972, and Kissinger's basically, he's actually written this, that he thought that Taiwan would disappear within a couple years. It didn't happen, and it didn't happen for a lot of reasons, and so, you know, for all the other reasons why a grand bargain is just an atrocious idea, it's just, as you point out, it's just not going to work. It hasn't worked in the past. It's not going to work in the future.
Yeah.
So those are all great points, just to throw in a few. I mean, one, most of what the U.S. would have to give away in a grand bargain would simply accelerate a power transition with China. To those in the audience who've had international relations afflicted on them by certain professors, you probably all, of course, have read arguments that ultimately, if you make a bargain and a country becomes stronger, it can always relitigate. I would say that certainly applies in this case. There's nothing to guarantee that a bargain today won't be relitigated tomorrow in a much less favorable direction. And related to that, China's regime type, when you have a country that is centralized authority, non-transparency, there's not a lot of assurances that it won't change, and it could change very quickly. So in my perspective, a grand bargain, if anything, would hasten the day for the power transition to fully happen, as opposed to prevent it or lock in U.S. gains.
Yeah, if I could just add one more thing, sorry, which is that I think along those lines, I think you don't get stuff from a grand bargain. You need to earn it. And it seems to me that China's not there yet. That China needs to reach a place, both in terms of its internal politics, but also in terms of its external behavior, to earn the influence that would be stabilizing to the region, not to be preemptively given away by outside parties.
Let me just not rise in defense of the grand bargain, but explain why it's not dead yet, and why we should be on our guard, those of us who care about Asia and about Japan and about Taiwan and about getting China right. The grand bargain pops up for two reasons that are gonna, and it will happen again, I predict, at some point. One is that policymakers at senior levels who view the paramount challenge of our time as transnational challenges, non-proliferation, climate change, or financial crises, don't care about Asia strategy. And that's why you had this pop up in the Obama administration, and why, for example, Secretary Kerry and Susan Rice were such champions of this idea, because they thought the most important thing facing the U.S. was climate change, followed by proliferation. But yet, to solve these, you need China's enormous weight in the international economy, and old-fashioned, you know, 19th century geographically bound issues like the first island chain are so old thing. So that is number one. Not everyone in this town agrees that we need a regional strategy, or that the challenge to the liberal order is coming from regional revisionist powers. A lot of people would argue that the big challenges are global, and not just climate change. You know, frankly, I think for Wall Street, the financial crisis and management of the financial system, hence you have the G2 idea coming out of Wall Street. The second reason is that very often these grand bargains with China are orchestrated by transatlanticists, by strategic thinkers who consider Asia a secondary theater. I think in my book, I argued part of the Kissinger strategy with China was not just recalibrating the balance of power in Asia, but more important, I think, was recalibrating the balance of power in Europe and getting the U.S. out of Vietnam and reconstituting NATO to deal with the Central Front. Now, over half of Americans and Poles now say Asia is the most important region, but our strategic leadership is overwhelmingly coming out of a sort of transatlantic NATO tradition or counterterrorism. And so those of us who care about Asia, and I think we're all in agreement on this, we should not be complacent. We have to remain vigilant, because I worry it could come back. I saw it in the Bush administration. It's an attractive idea when you're dealing with challenges around the world and you want a simple, convenient sort of grand move to deal with your problems. It's a terrible idea, but I worry it's not dead.
You're right, it's a terrible idea, but I do think it's dead. And the reason is, yes, I agree, we're in the swamp, and there are a lot of people here who come up with really bad ideas and they relentlessly pursue them. But the point is, we're not the world. You have the Chinese and the Russians are going to do things which are just going to be completely outside the bounds. Right. It's going to offend not only people, you know, out in places in the United States where the people have common sense, but also in Washington as well. And you know, you see this, for instance, when Putin took over Crimea. You know, he's now moving on eastern Ukraine. He's talking about the Baltics. The Chinese now are starting to say, look, we not only want the South China Sea, but we're also thinking of the Ryukyus and Okinawa because they were a tributary state 200 years ago. And so, therefore, it's ours now. You know, it just seems that because of the dynamics inside of Beijing and Moscow, this idea will die, and it will also delegitimize a lot of people in Washington, which would be the second good thing about all of this. Because there are, I think, a core of people in Washington who have really forgotten the values of what have made the United States great. We've forgotten Ronald Reagan. We've forgotten the revolution. We've just forgotten all of this stuff. And it's important that we start to understand who we are as a people and what we stand for. And really, the one reason why we do have a reason to exercise power abroad, and that is because our values are consistent with those of the rest of the world. People want the things that when they say American-led international system, it's really not American-led. It's a system that embodies values that everyone wants.
Well, that's a good segue.
On the right side of history.
Dan, I want to move to you quickly and perhaps give a chance to for the audience panelists to comment before moving to the audience Q&A. Is that in your comments, in your book, you've attached a great deal of importance on democracies and moderating the effects of this sort of destructive power transition that you foresee coming along, given the nature of the regimes in question. Are you concerned by the perceived low priority that this administration seemingly places on supporting democracies or the role of sort of democracies and values in foreign policy? What kind of impact will this have on this sort of type of transition that you see coming?
So if you look at China specifically, in general, democracy promotion has not been a high priority for the United States, and it is very challenging, of course. And I mean, I would certainly advocate, whether it's with China or any other society, that pushing for elections overnight has unfortunately been proven to typically not result in democracy. You don't have the institutions, rule of law, the traditions that then enable democracy to ultimately emerge. And in that sense, Taiwan is an evocative example where you had a sort of everything in place and then a transition. I think to the extent that we can in China, which is very difficult, whether it's supporting NGOs or rule of law, quiet exchanges, we should try. And again, it's a challenge. I know it's not a high priority now. It's not been a high priority, I think, typically. Mike can correct me if I'm wrong there. But in terms of in general, I mean, I think a lot of administrations move back and forth on the importance of democracy, but typically, ultimately, they do come to realize that it does matter, not just in terms of values, but ultimately it advances U.S. interests over the long term. So I hope, anyways, the pendulum will swing.
Okay, great. All right, well, I'll open up to audience Q&A. Please raise your hand, identify yourself, and please keep your comments or questions brief. Garrett, middle.
Hi, name is Garrett Van Der Wies, former editor of Taiwan Communique, and he also just joined GTI as an advisor. You have all talked about the grand strategy for the U.S. in East Asia. and you have emphasized democracy in that respect. I'm from Europe, and we also have a few democracies there. What would be the possibility? How can we link in Europe into this grand strategy from the US side to ensure that interests from the European side don't conflict with American interests or, in our case, Taiwan's interests?
Well, Garrett, you have both Beijing and Washington working much more closely together, coordinating their foreign policies. And while you have the Chinese threatening their neighbors, you also have Russia threatening its neighbors. And eventually, I think people are going to start to see, even in Europe, that this is an issue that Daniel just talked about in terms of democracy promotion, and which has been a theme this morning. So I think that we're going to get to the point where, even though we don't want another Cold War, it's going to become evident that there is a coalition of countries that do intend to threaten not only their neighbors, but also the whole concept of the international order and democracy.
It's not going to be easy with Europe. A decade ago or so, we were wrestling with the European move to lift the arms embargo on China. And I and a few other officials at the time threw ourselves in front of that train. And the Europeans argued with us that we didn't understand China. And I remember one prominent European foreign minister was lecturing me about how you can't contain China. And I said, do you know who China's, at the time, China's seventh largest trading partner was? And the person said, it must be Italy. And I said, no, it's Walmart. That the U.S., you know, has a pretty robust relationship with China. We're way past that now. I think there's more of a convergence of thinking than there was. The problem is that Beijing has realized that the European Union is deliciously dividable. And, the decision last summer, for example, by the tribunal on the Philippine case, and the law of the EU could not put out a statement because China bought off Greece and Hungary. And so just as we're starting to see, I think, some recognition among European leaders that they do have to do what Gordon's saying, the way the EU works, all the structural flaws, all the inwardness right now in Europe, the Chinese have found ways to manipulate that. And so one step forward, one step back, Gordon's right, there's an opportunity there. It's going to take a lot of work.
Rick Fisher, also on the advisor of GTI, and proud of that. Just imagine that you're in Beijing, you're a key staffer on the North America leading group, and that you're in charge of the grand bargain file. What is on your list? What do you want, not just from the United States, but from others, to seal the bargain and project China's dominance into the future?
Well, I'll start. It is to peacefully win American acquiescence in PRC, domination over the Western Pacific, and that peacefully, which means, which is why the new model of great power relations is such useful anesthesia for this surgical operation to remove U.S. influence and power from the Western Pacific. And the key elements of that involve neutralizing values as a narrative in the region, which means standing up for the principle of non-interference in internal affairs, which Japan and other countries used to champion. Now they fight against it because they see what's up. And it means weakening the credibility of U.S. alliances, beating up the weak links up the island chain, the Philippines, to killing the chicken to scare the monkey, which is Japan, or our commitments to Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act. Articulating, as Xi Jinping did 3 years ago in Shanghai, a vision of a region with no blocks, so weaken the U.S. alliance system. With the alliance system, as Toshi said, goes the geography and the alliance system, the values are linked. And you start breaking those apart and affect what's called the near sea doctrine. It's not called that anymore in Beijing, but the sort of Monroe Doctrine control over the First and Second Island Change, which historically are the claustrophobic thing containing China. And, you know, all going to plan, unless and until, in my view, U.S. alliances actually get stronger because of what China's doing, which means missile defense. It means strengthening U.S., Japan, Korea trilateral cooperation in the face of North Korea. It means more support for Taiwan. It means more linkages of Taiwan to Japan. If the San Francisco Treaty system and the bilateral alliance system will not become a collective security system easily, but if the Chinese see that their coercion and aggression and their support for North Korea is de facto creating through missile defense, intelligence cooperation, maritime cooperation, a collective security type of interoperability among our allies, that will ruin the China dream. And so it's on us to make that happen and to demonstrate the consequences. If we overplay our hand, it won't work. But you know, China, as other panelists have said, have created an opportunity to start not only reconstituting our alliances, but connecting them.
Rick, I think the number one item on the to-do list would be to get the United States to start talking to North Korea. Because, you know, everything Mike said is absolutely right, but in terms of, like, what do you do today to get to where Mike is talking about, I think you have to remove the one item where the United States could actually brand China as an enemy and therefore sort of get that off the table so that you can then go out and do all those other things. You know, with regard to North Korea, you know, right now people in this town understandably believe that there's a time frame. You know, somewhere between 9 to 15 months, the North Koreans will be able to put a nuclear warhead on top of a missile that'll be able to reach the American homeland. And because of that, that drives a lot of policy in directions where, you know, it was unthinkable. We're hearing all sorts of things from, you know, established foreign policy players that we would not have heard, let's say, last month or 2 months ago. So, for instance, Admiral Stravitis talks about an embargo on North Korea. So if you're a Chinese foreign policy implementer, you've got to get this issue off the agenda because it's the one thing that can really wreck all of your long-term plans because China is never going to help on North Korea, and they know that, and so therefore they've got to get it off the agenda.
Well, Gordon, I just want to raise a point here, and this, and you addressed it to a degree, and that is, you know, this is an area of concern, right, North Korea, because, you know, much ink has been spilled, really, about the transactional nature of President Trump and how this impacts the administration's foreign policy. And so, and given that the sort of security, the key security issue is clearly North Korea now, in the course of trying to get China to do more on North Korea, will Taiwan be used as a bargaining chip in effort, U.S. efforts to apply maximum pressure?
Well, you know, the Taiwan and North Korea have always been linked, as everyone has said. Mao Zedong did not invade Taiwan because he had to come to North Korea's aid. And, you know, we see Chinese, and Mike would know this better than anybody, you know, have oftentimes hinted at least that type of bargain. You know, and Trump is perfectly capable of breaking all sorts of conventions, like democracy conventions and things like that. You know, those notions that we hold dear. But I actually don't think that this is in the cards right now, largely because we are not looking at those issues. We're looking specifically at how do you disarm North Korea. And I actually believe that we do not think that the Chinese, and I think foreign policy analysts are wrong, but I think that we're starting to see people say, well, China can't solve this. If you believe China can't solve North Korea, then you're not going to bargain away Taiwan. So I although I'm sure Beijing would love to actually start a discussion like that with the Trump administration, even if they do, it's not going to go anywhere.
Toshi? Could I go back to Rick's question about what China wants? I think the Chinese have been surprisingly transparent about what they want. So in late 2014, I think Xi Jinping laid out his key objectives for the China dream. There's one component that I think is worrisome and is already in play, which is China's attempts to rewrite the rules and norms that China was not present in the post-war period to participate in shaping and in making. So the Chinese believe that there are certain norms and rules that do not favor Chinese interests, and that they will try to revise, at a minimum, revise those rules and norms to suit China's growing power and growing interest. And that includes, of course, China's interpretation of what's allowable in its exclusive economic zone. And to me, that normative objection is very much related to our hard power, because what they're essentially trying to do is to curtail our ability to militarily access key parts of maritime Asia. And if they're able to demonstrate that they can, in fact, curtail our ability or our willingness to do so, that will in turn undermine our allies' confidence in America's ability to maintain that favorable balance of power that I've talked about. And that is one way of essentially unraveling America's position in East Asia.
Just to jump in quickly on Rick's question, I think if I was assigned to the Grand Bargain portfolio, I might be worried. I was one step before being purged that I would be fairly pessimistic that I could accomplish it, that maybe you could have a half bargain a bit in part due to the comments on North Korea. Can China really deliver North Korea? I'd be very concerned that I'd been set up for failure and was going somewhere else. So I, not a good portfolio to hold, I would think.
All right. With that, please join me in thanking the first group panelists.
Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it.